Hello and welcome to The Right Side. It is Saturday, October 6th, and we are in the final hours leading up to a debate over Brett Kavanaugh's final nomination vote or confirmation vote. So before we get to our great discussion with mental health, marital and relationship counselor and therapist, Allison Efferson, who you may remember from the podcast Coffee and Markets. We have Jay Caruso on here to talk a little bit about what happened yesterday with the cloture vote and what we've kind of gone through with announcements over who's voting yes, who's voting no, who's going to be there, who's not. So Jay, how were the last 30 hours for you? I'm tired.
Yeah, I think everyone's tired. I will say that while the Washington Post and the New York Times, their editorial boards, urge senators to vote no on confirming Brett Kavanaugh, the Dallas Morning News editorial board, we published an editorial expressing that the Senate should confirm Brett Kavanaugh as a Supreme Court justice. And the main reason we came down to, and the editorial is really well written, somebody should go read it. It's a difficult situation, not easy. This wasn't like, oh, it's a slam dunk. But essentially what our board reached was similar to the conclusion that Susan Collins reached on her speech on the Senate floor yesterday, which was 43 minutes long. And was terrific, and everybody should go watch it, because she pretty much, you know, for all of the talk that we've had lately about, you know, how the Senate is like not acting the way it should and they're not doing the things that they normally should do, her speech was a perfect example of how the Senate should behave. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of came to the same conclusion that, look, nobody's discounting Christine Blasey Ford's, you know, accusation. The other one, I forgot her first name, Ramirez.
Betty.
Debbie Ramirez. Deborah Ramirez, you know, they're not discounting that one either. They are discounting the third one. I think Collins called it preposterous, and that is the Wittnick accusation, which got floated by that nutcase Michael Avenatti, and there was just absolutely no corroborating evidence whatsoever. Nobody even would back her story up, and her story changed while she was on national television. Mm-hmm. So badly that the NBC, before they aired it, said, we couldn't confirm with anybody that this happened, and she changed her story. It was like they were almost apologizing for having to air it. That's how bad it was. So that's the reason why the FBI didn't bother interviewing anybody related to that accusation. So it was the first two that were at stake. And the fact of the matter is that, look, the fact that they weren't serious allegations, but they could not be proven. They could not be corroborated. It was he said, she said. In fact, the second one was more like he said after 30 years and 6 days, I remembered suddenly that it was Brett Kavanaugh. A lot of this talk that you heard from Democrats about the FBI investigation not being thorough, that's nonsense. Mm-hmm. The FBI spoke to all witnesses that had direct knowledge of these supposed events. The FBI is not going to sit there and go and interview somebody who said they overheard a conversation with someone 30 years ago that the New Yorker said happened. And when the New Yorker tracked down the person that supposedly made the statements that this other person overheard, the person said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, and so people were complaining the FBI didn't interview these people. And it was this wasn't a fishing expedition. This wasn't a criminal investigation. As everyone said, this was a job interview, right? So the FBI did what was in the parameters of what they were supposed to do, was a supplemental background investigation. Everybody wanted Mark Judge questioned by the FBI. He was. Everybody wanted the other witnesses, Leland Kaiser, PJ, the other two friends that were identified on Brett Kavanaugh's calendar, everybody said they should be interviewed by the FBI. They were. Deborah Ramirez, they said she should be interviewed by the FBI. She was. And there was somebody associated with that was interviewed by the FBI. All of that came to the point where, even though the FBI report hasn't been released, Nobody, because if there was something in there that corroborated any of those stories, the Democrats would have been out there and said, we can't say what it is, but we can guarantee you there's information in here that corroborates those accusations. And not a single person said that.
Yeah.
All they did was complain that the investigation wasn't, quote unquote, thorough enough. That was nothing but a ruse to throw a cloud over the investigation.
Yeah. So now yesterday we had first Jeff Flake come out and say that he voted for cloture, and he voted and he said that he says that he's going to vote yes on Kavanaugh. Now, I personally want Jeff Flake put in a room until he is, and only allow him out when he is going to vote, because with his flip-floppiness last weekend or last week on Friday. But then, like you said, Susan Collins gave a great speech. You know, everybody was like, okay, you know what, she's you know, we complain about her a lot, but she is a Republican, and she made the right, you know, she kind of like followed the right logic and thought process, and she really debated about it personally and for her constituents. You have Susan Collins, and you know, they're now being threatened. They're being you've got three. I think they said there was around 300 protesters outside the Capitol today. In you know, Lindsey Graham, who has been an outspoken advocate for supporter of Kavanaugh throughout the process, being chased by protesters. Thankfully, none of these people. I mean, police are having to really protect our senators right now. I can't imagine what Joe Manchin is probably dealing with just within his, because he is, you know, still a quote unquote Democrat. But he also came out and said that he voted for cloture, and he said that he is a yes on Kavanaugh, which is a good thing, because he is in a state that voted for Trump, I think, by 40 points. So, you know, he's kind of in a different position. Now, we do have Lisa Murkowski, who voted against cloture, but came out yesterday because we've been dealing with this situation with Senator Steve Daines from Montana, whose daughter is getting married today. And she basically came out and did it was an amazing speech in how weak it was. I don't know if you felt that way when you were watching Murkowski's speech. I don't know if you watched it, but she was, it was like the opposite flip of Senator Collins. Murkowski was just weak in her speech and in her reasoning. But she said that she's going to vote present, so that Steve Daines doesn't have to rush back, which is a kind of something that senators have done historically.
Yeah, and Murkowski, what a lot of people are missing with Murkowski is that, you know, all these women are thanking her for voting no, and honestly, though, Murkowski's bigger reason for not voting for Kavanaugh has nothing to do with the sexual assault allegations. It has to do with Alaskan natives who are, you know, indigenous communities in Alaska came out against Kavanaugh the moment he was nominated. The reason why is because this relates actually to Hawaii. There are federal protections and everything for Hawaiian natives. There's actually, like, they actually hold elections in certain areas of Hawaii where only Hawaiian natives can vote. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you're Japanese, if you're white, if you're African American, you can't vote in those elections because they're only specifically for Hawaiian natives. And Alaskan natives do the same thing. And Kavanaugh actually came out and said, that may not be good. That may not be right. And so they were ferociously against his nomination from the start. And those Alaskan natives played a large role getting Murkowski elected as a write-in candidate.
Right.
You know, back in 2010, I think it was. So, you know, so there's more to it than the Kavanaugh allegations with Murkowski than just, you know, just the whole Me Too thing. So everybody's wondering why. Well, these two always vote together. Why is this? Well, that's the reason why it's different. They're a big lobby. They're very strongly opposed to Kavanaugh, and they could hurt her in the next election. So It makes a little bit more sense for her to do it. Collins, on the other hand, she has remained consistent. She's been a senator since 1997. She has not voted against a Supreme Court nomination since that time. And so that would include, you know, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and now Donald Trump. You know, she basically said the same thing we said in our editorial. Like I said before, there wasn't enough corroboration or evidence to say that to support the allegation. And in that respect, you have to go back and look at his record, look at his time on the DC circuit, look at what the ABA has said about him, look about what other colleagues have said about him. And at that point, you say there's no reason to vote against them as a result. So she's been the one big voice of reason in all of this.
Yeah. So Flake, what do you think his motivations have been? I mean, he's been apparently in talks for he's leaving the Senate, and he's apparently been in talks to have, a contributorship to, probably MSNBC or something.
Probably. I mean, he'll probably wind up on a news channel or something like that. I think Flake has been, part of this has been to maybe torture Donald Trump as much as he possibly can, just to kind of needle him the entire way. Of course, that's not going to matter. People are just going to, the women's march is just going to refer to him as a rape apologist the way they did with Susan Collins, by voting to confirm. And that's where, just so we get to this, talking about guys like Ben Sasse and Bob Corker and Jeff Flake and Susan Collins and everything like that, you've had these accusations going out. The Republicans are all Trumpists and they don't have any principle. And I'm tired of that stupid argument, okay? Because it is not a principled stand to vote against someone, confirming someone that you would have voted to confirm no matter what if the president was somebody other than Donald Trump. It's fair to say that Donald Trump has been a large cog or a large spark in this kind of contentious political atmosphere we have. No doubt about that. Not going to disagree with that at all. But somehow or another to sit there and say, well, we're going to hold Trump to account by voting against stuff that we would normally vote for otherwise is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. It's the Jen Rubin philosophy of conservatism.
Conservatism, and everybody considers they're willing to do the right thing for the country. These people have a constituency that they have to answer to in their states. We keep seeing America as this big whole lump, and everybody has to, you're a senator from Nebraska and you're supposed to placate people who live in Arizona. I don't see how that's the case. Mm-hmm. Ben Sasse has a constituency in Nebraska that he is representing. And he is saying, I think Brett Kavanaugh is qualified for the Supreme Court, and I'm going to vote for him. Now, if the people he represents in Nebraska sit there and say that's a bridge too far, they'll vote him out. That's how the system works. But this idea that people are supposed to do something, in the name of the betterment of the country, which is vote Democrat, vote down people you'd vote to confirm otherwise, and vote against legislation that you would support otherwise, is preposterous.
Didn't Nebraska already vote out one of the Tea Party candidates a couple years ago?
I don't remember.
Possibly. Yeah, I think it was one of the primaries or something. I think in 2016, actually. I only know this from all my work with the Decision Desk, but I could be wrong. Maybe it was Kansas. It was one of those states. I always get them mixed up. Not mixed up, but just I don't care. This probably sounds horrible. I just don't care about Kansas, Nebraska. It's like, I don't know. They're both corn states.
The idea is that it's absurd to argue that Ben Sasse or Bob Corker are not principled because they criticize Trump but then vote for the stuff that helps Trump. But if they're also thinking that if they thought the tax cut is going to help the country, if they thought if they believe that Brett Kavanaugh is a good choice for the Supreme Court, they are voting in principle. Now you can argue that they're not doing enough to say, let's pull back Trump's authority that he's exercising on tariffs. But then, there's certain people you're not going to get to go along with that. And unfortunately, as I live in Texas, it's like Ted Cruz and John Cornyn weren't willing to do that. So you're fighting an inner battle there. So you may get a bunch of Democrats to support you and say, okay, we're voting to overturn this one part of that law that he uses to impose tariffs based upon national security concerns, but the president's going to veto it, mm-hmm. and you're not going to have a two-thirds majority to overturn it. So what are you doing? It's symbolic at that point. It's kind of like, that's the whole
overturning
thing.
Overturning the ACA 90-something
exactly.
times.
Yeah. Exactly. They want their people, and we know who we're talking about. We're talking about the stronger elements of Never Trump, like Jen Rubin, like Max Boot, and people like that, who want Republicans in Congress to do the same kind of thing that they railed about people in Congress doing when Barack Obama was president. You know, so Ted Cruz was sitting there saying, we can defeat Obamacare if we stand on principle. You know, and they were like, you can't do that. You don't have the votes to do it. This is stupid. What's your strategy? The same thing applies. They want him to do the same thing.
Right. And just to kind of like, you know, wrap it up. I mean, I did see someone and it does come down to kind of, you know, elements of Republicanism and conservatism and where do we go from here? But, I think I retweeted it. I think it was AG Conservative said, but he basically said, look, you want us to vote with Democrats, which I said even when people were encouraging that, people like, I think it was Bill Kristol encouraging that kind of thing. It was like, no, I'm not doing that. And the Democrats gave us a perfect example over the last month for why you're going to vote with the people who just did this to Brett Kavanaugh. I mean,
it said all of the norms and overturning all the norms and stuff like that of all these things that happen. You know, it's like here, perfect example is this whole thing about the FBI investigation that the FBI didn't interview Kavanaugh or Ford. And they're saying the FBI interviewed Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And so they're breaking precedent with that. No, they're not.
They were federal employees.
Well, that was that case. That was number one. Number two, there wasn't a public hearing yet. The allegations surfaced behind closed doors. Joe Biden went to the White House and said, this is what's happening. The White House said, okay, you know what? Let's go ahead and have the FBI investigate this and you know, to kind of do interviews and see what happens. They did. The FBI turned over its report to the White House. The White House says, we don't see there's any foundation. We don't see these charges seem unfounded. You know, it's he said, she said, there's all this other kind of stuff. Then she signed an affidavit saying Clarence Thomas did this stuff, but she still wanted to remain anonymous. She didn't want it out in the public. And guess what happened? It was leaked to the public. Three weeks later, they had, just before the eve of Thomas's nomination vote or confirmation vote, is when that was leaked to the press, to NPR and to Newsday. Oh, all of a sudden his thing is delayed by a few weeks because now they have to have these hearings. The hearings in this case happened first. There was no reason for the FBI to interview them. And then Dianne Feinstein saying, well, we're not experienced investigators and we only had 5 minutes. And I think it was Judiciary Committee's Twitter account that said, well, maybe you should have brought in an experienced investigator to ask the questions like they did. As for the 5 minutes, maybe you shouldn't have spent 3 to 3.5 minutes of that five making a political speech before you decided to ask questions.
Yeah. And then they and something about that they demanded 5 minutes. So like, yes. They're the ones that set the 5 minute rule. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, well, up or down, does Brett Kavanaugh get confirmed before Monday morning?
He does. And I will guarantee you that, you know, the House is still in play, but Democrats are not going to take over the Senate. And if Susan Collins decides to run again in 2020, she will win with more than 60% of the vote. I can almost virtually guarantee that.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. I mean, as I've always been wrong on Trump, so I could be wrong again. Hopefully not. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, you know, national elections are different than statewide elections. So that's the one thing we do know. So, all right, Jay, thank you so much for coming on to just run this down. Hopefully there will be no more Kavanaugh talk. So this might be the last time that Kim and I, we've had a straight run of a month of Kavanaugh podcasts, including one with you. So where you put your foot down and played the diva card and got your 20 minutes or 30 minutes of talking Kavanaugh. Now you've gotten
yes,
a few more. Yes. So, all right. You can go find him on Twitter at Jay Caruso. And now for our great conversation with therapist Allison Efferson talking about Mental Health Awareness Week, which starts October 7th and goes through October 13th. The color for mental health is green, so wear your green and know that you are supporting people, even just by, you know, talking about it or posting something about it on social media, that you are at least, you know, doing what we see a lot of other people doing with certain pet projects. And this one is obviously, to anyone listening, is personal to me. So I give to you me and Allison Efferson. I, for once, am not here with my co-host Kimberly Ross. She is under the weather this week, so we are giving her the week off. But I do have with me here is a marriage and family therapist intern. She's on her way to being a fully fledged marriage and family therapist. But Allison, she's here. You can find her on Twitter at, I think it's ADP Efferson.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. So, I wanted to bring you on this week because we've had some kind of social media conversations when I've shared things about mental illness and eating disorders mm-hmm. and things like that. Because anyone who's listened to the show knows that I struggled with those for about over 8 years and almost a decade. This starting tomorrow is National Mental Health Awareness Week, and it's always one of these awareness weeks. I mean, we've got Gay Pride Week, and we've got all these different kind of weeks. I never really ever see anything about, you know, which the color for mental illness is green. You never really hear that much about Mental Health Awareness Week during Mental Health Awareness Week, and I think that, at least in my opinion, I think it's because mental illness, while it's more talked about now than ever before, and we understand it a little bit better, it's still not perfect, but it's still a taboo thing to talk about and to admit to. How do you take that? I mean, is that what you kind of think as well? Or are there other aspects for why? Is there no interest, no money there?
Well, there are probably myriad reasons why, I suspect, but if you go on the, I think it's the National Association of Mental Illness website, one of the first things that you're going to see is eliminating stigma, I think, is they've got a whole front page of how we need to destigmatize mental illness. As far as I see, as a therapist, people who come in to see me, stigma is not usually one of the issues that we address. It's not at the forefront of their mind. But then again, I'm seeing people who have already accepted that there's an issue and they're coming in. Mm-hmm. So that may not be the right demographic to make that assumption about. But but we do we've seen a far greater push, at least. And if you look in the with the military, especially. With PTSD being something that's pretty prevalent at the forefront of conversation, mm-hmm. Because we have, I think, you know, military personnel taking their own lives, and you've got that happening, and you've got soldiers coming back and finally coming to terms with, yeah, maybe I do need to talk to somebody. But there is still a great deal of stigma attached. If you ever talk to a veteran, you're going to find that out immediately, that this is not something that they necessarily want people knowing about or want to maybe not want to talk or come to terms with themselves, or they think they can deal with it. I don't know, you know, having those conversations, you find out that there still is a little bit of a guardedness about speaking openly about their suffering. So mm-hmm.
I think at least in, I mean, I don't have PTSD, but just having, at least I think overcome, well, I still have, you know, sometimes an anxiety disorder. A lot of times I can talk, but with myself, like, I kind of, like, have to be tough on myself and kind of tell myself, you're not going to let this anxiety, like, cut it out. You do not have anxiety. Just buckle down.
So but you're very cognitive about how you address it.
But that was also after a decade of work. I mean, what I was going to say, though, is that I think a lot of times, at least for myself, is that kind of walking around and talking about it, a lot of times I think comes off as that you are marking yourself off as like, oh, this person with this struggle and kind of almost like a victim mentality. And to me, and I can only speak for myself. But like, you know, I know that for, you know, some people it probably does like, oh, there's a weakness there, you know, like you're not, you know, able to cope with things and you're kind of, you know, pushing things back or off or not wanting to, you don't want to come off as seeming not normal. Nobody ever wants to be not normal, except for, you know, my 10-year-old daughter who constantly tells me that being weird is cool. But,
how nice.
Yeah. But I guess in, to me, it has always been like, you know, admitting to a weakness or a fault, which, you know, maybe that makes me like prideful or something like that. But I think that there might be, you know, especially for military members, you know, that they're, you know, I know that a lot of them always feel, a personal friend of mine, Greg, you know, feels guilty that he's, you know, that he made it through, and why am I complaining and, you know, having, you know, dealing with this when, you know, my friends aren't even around to deal with this kind of stuff, you know, like,
yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. And survivor's guilt, I mean, you could have a whole show talking about mm-hmm. how that affects families and service members. But to address the idea that individuals feel as though seeking counseling is some sort of marker of failing as a human, I think.
Oh, yeah.
That there is something to that. I've you know, heard from multiple people who don't want to, and couples, marriage counseling seems to be one of these, one of the greater, where I find a greater preponderance of that thinking is, you know, we don't want to have marriage counseling because we don't want to come to terms with our marriage isn't working, or what are they going to tell me? Or, I mean, all mm-hmm. manner of things. And, you know, it just makes it more complicated because you have another person involved, but there's that. But as far as, yeah, there is a feeling of I should be able to do this on my own. And I think Western culture really perpetuates that. I mean, and especially in America, think about how we founded this country. I mean, it, literally 60 people came mm-hmm. here from who survived. Well, actually, I think it was 120 and like half of them died. But I mean, we are pioneers. We're frontiersmen. We are people who, you know, hacked a living out of the woods. And so there is this independent spirit about us that says you should be able to do this without having to, you know, go see a shrink. And also, historically, we as therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists have historically been thought of as, you know, the last ditch effort to save an insane person. Mm-hmm. So we have that to overcome. But also, I'm going to just, if I could add to that, there's also the flip side of that, which is the stigma of seeing a therapist means that you're somehow kooky, and that, you know, again, it's only insane people go and see a therapist. So there is quite a bit there going on culturally and individually.
Yeah, I would say, and just for anybody listening, like I, you know, I haven't gone, I went for about 4 years every week to go see, you know, talk therapy and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I still, every couple years, I will go back just to be kind of like, I need to just make sure that my head is on right. And most of the time I get in there and they're kind of like, after like, you know, two or three visits, it's just kind of like, but you know what you need to fix. So you're sitting here talking to me, telling me it's like, okay, I just wanted to make sure. I mean, there is something to, you know, checking in. And yes, I don't have that kind of, you know, feeling of stigma about it. I used to, but you know, it's like I'm getting married and I've told my fiance, I'm like, we will probably like, be going to marriage counseling even when things are just fine, just because I'm going to want to make sure yeah. and just talk to somebody and be like, can you tell me that this is all fine and we're good? Because I don't trust myself, I guess is my kind of main thing. But you know, it's like, it's always good to have somebody else's opinion. And even if it's just to find out that you're fine. One of the things that, you sent me to talk about is that we do have much more access and ways to get help. I mean, a part of almost every healthcare plan now. I think there's 10 to 12 visits that you know, even through work, you know, you can go and, yeah. and talk to a talk that, you know, go to therapy and just talk about, you know, even if it's just small things. I know when I had my accident, my mom's, because she was my mother, my mom's work had a, you know, she could go and talk to them about what she was dealing with me before my accident and after my accident, because I was an absolute mess before my accident. Yeah. I mean, there is a certain level of crisis when you've, you know, tried to kill yourself 3 times in 7 months, yeah. you know, kind of thing. And, but anyway, so we do have this new bill that is now on President Trump's desk that was passed by the Senate, I think 98-1. And mm-hmm. So what I saw kind of in the article that you sent about it, and it always kind of makes me step back when it's like Mike Lee was the only person to vote against it. But yeah, but it sounds like, you know, they're trying to fix the problem, but is it? It seemed like psychologists and psychiatrists that were kind of asked about it were kind of like, well, this is kind of a Band-Aid, but it doesn't fund after this year or after the first year.
Is this the opioid bill?
Yes.
Well, I was encouraged to see that there was a bill that got anywhere in the Obama administration. I think it was year 2016 where it was ever addressed. If I'm incorrect, people will let you know. But at least my understanding when I did the research was that wasn't even addressed legislatively until 2016. So to see that this was that something had gone through and had been passed was encouraging. I worked with addicts in an addiction clinic, and when you're on the ground level, you see things a little bit differently than policymakers. I thought the bill was good. I thought that, you know, letting people stay longer than 2 weeks in a facility that had more than 16 beds was probably a good idea. Mm-hmm. And just kind of reworking how we treat opioid addiction was good. But at the ground level where you're actually treating these individuals, there is a disconnect. I wish that lawmakers would go and see addiction clinics and talk to people. And they may have. I mean, I don't know. But you get a strong sense that really, I mean, legislatively, we really are. It is a Band-Aid. This is an issue that's deep-seated with individuals. And it's, you know, policy can only do so much. What we're really seeing and what I came away with from that experience was that we're broken. I mean, people really are broken and they're hurting. And addiction is one of those, substance addiction is one of those really insidious things. Statistically, roughly 60 to 70% of the population that's on a substance will self-elect to get off. And generally that happens because the environment becomes untenable for them. Mm-hmm. Either their families, you know, wife says, I'm leaving you, or work says you're fired. I mean, so they are, the consequences of continuing that behavior are negative to the degree and motivating to change. So they're motivated to change. So 60 to 70% will self-elect to get off of the substance. Now, this tragic part of this, and I don't think we've quite identified why, but the 30% or so that are left of that group that has to seek treatment, only 5% really ever come out of it. And that's an astounding number. I mean, when you think about that, that's terrible science. I mean, statistically, that's terrible. I mean, that is not a success.
Yeah, do you think it's because we don't, like, again, this is just from personal experience, but eating disorder is a lot like addiction. I'm always amazed at how similar the brain processes, it's a habit. I mean, it becomes this insidious thing. But the thing that I always, at least in my experience, my accident was what ended up, you know, being the catalyst, but that's because I was in a facility for 7 months. Yeah. 7 months and 11 months kind of total, between the hospital and then just being in, you know, a nursing facility, not anything for mental illness, but just because I had lost, you know, half of my limbs, you know, so it was, I mean, you know, it's just, do you think that a part of that is that, you know, like you said, 2 weeks in a facility, 2 weeks is not long enough to cure an addiction of any kind, really. And then, and the kind of like relapse and return rate is also really high among those people that do have to seek treatment.
Yeah. You make a good point, actually. And to speak to the eating disorder component of your statement, because of that, eating disorder facilities that treat these people have extended stays now. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're realizing that, you know, you take the 14-year-old girl who's 78 pounds and 5'8", and she's not going to get better in 2 weeks.
Right.
And I think I think that your listenership may not know this, but eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of all the mental illness. Mm-hmm. It's roughly around 50%. So this is huge. I mean, this is not a small thing to be losing it's largely girls, to be losing our girls to this disorder is catastrophic. And so we do know now that we do have to have long-term plans to treat people. Part of the reason why that is because your brain is getting, you know, your brain rewires. And you're right, habit forms neurological pathways to do certain things because your brain is an efficiency machine. If you do this, it's going to want to do it the most efficient way. And so that's why it takes time to do anything. And I talk to my clients about this, that this is the process. And ideally, you know, there is some grumbling that goes on with, well, why would you need to be in therapy for 3 years or 4 years? Well, because it takes that long to get yourself thinking correctly. It just does. I mean, you didn't get there overnight, and your brain has been wiring itself to, it's been adapting to your behavior patterns and your thought processes for, you know, 19, 20, 24, however long you've been doing it. And so it does take time. It takes more than 2 weeks. It takes more than, in many cases, more than 12 sessions. I wish insurance companies would pay for more than that, but that's a whole other topic. but it just neurologically takes that long for people to start to change, for people to start to have that become natural, or at the very least become less difficult or easier to overcome. So,
yeah, I think changing the way you're thinking is one of those things. It's one of those things that, like, I look back and think, like, wow, I really, like, did something major and kind of, like, even to me, like, amazing that I can basically, like, that I've integrated, you know, kind of, like, I don't even think about it as, like, meditation or anything like that. It's seriously just a, 'cause along with my eating disorder, what kind of started was also an extreme anxiety disorder. And so it's like to kind of, like, being able to kind of almost sit back without even kind of, like, telling anybody or realize I'm doing it and just automatically just kind of, like, doing things. But it's that much therapy where you kind of, you know, you do guided meditation with your therapist or even a group of people at times, you know, I mean, and these were things that I was forced to do, you know, because you do end up getting into certain kinds of, you know, and I didn't have a bunch of legal problems, but I did have a bunch of things that, you know, my mom always said, I was a great mom until about the last 2 months. But then, you know, it's like I ended up paying more attention to my eating disorder than my 2-year-old daughter, you know, kind of things like that. And so it's like, so then, you know, you get told that you have to, you know, you must go to parenting classes. Well, that part of that parenting class is learning how to do guided meditation. And that's something that you go through for maybe 6 months to a year, but you ultimately learn how to do it. If you're really conscious about it and conscientious about it, then it becomes something that you just incorporate as a part of who you are. And that takes a lot of time. Like you said, it takes, you know, people saying that they're, you know, in therapy for years, that means that they're being serious about it, I think, to me.
Yeah. And I'm impressed that your therapy included guided meditation. I think that those are, I mean, I know that some people go into the therapeutic process under protest, but what I tell my clients is to be patient with the process. And if you will trust it, it will benefit you. Now, I can't, you know, legally or ethically guarantee an outcome. I don't know if people will ever get better. And honestly, I can't cure anybody. Therapy to me is not a curative solution. It is, we're going to learn to live with reality. And as we get better, we're going to, you know, make better decisions, have better outlooks, better attitudes, relate differently to our problems so that we can function at the highest optimal capacity we're able to. Whether somebody ever, you know, stops being depressed or stops having anxiety, I don't know. But I do know that if we do things differently, relate differently, and have healthier ways of thinking about it, it can really remediate the effects, and to a degree that's experienced by the individual, at least, as a reduction in depression, anxiety, that type of thing.
Yeah. So the one other thing, and I just wanted to, I can't speak on this too much, but I did want to, because Kim was really looking forward to having you here to kind of talk about her struggles with postpartum depression. And is this something that we're, and I don't really know a ton about, is this something that we're seeing more of or less of? Is it the kind of the dichotomy of trying to work and be everything, or is it just something that's chemical that has more to do with, you know, your biology than your kind of life situation, I guess?
Yeah, the answer is yes. Yes. it is something I think we see more of it because women are more aware of what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, if we were to rewind the clock to 50 years ago, women who had postpartum might be institutionalized. I don't know. I imagine there were women who were. But yeah, we're seeing it because women are more aware of it and doctors know better how to diagnose it. And I gave a link, I don't know if you can put it up, about postpartum support groups, and just understanding what you're looking at, the animal you're looking at. Because I know that, first of all, I just want to just encourage all of the moms out there that if you have mom guilt, you are part of a good group of women, because we all have mom guilt. And I think one of the things, I preface my statement with that, because one of the things that I think prevents women from coming to terms with their postpartum depression is they feel like they're a bad mom, and or they're that they don't love their child, or whatever lie we tell ourselves as a mom, that we should be better, we should be able to handle this. Why am I not attaching to my child? What's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very well may not be you at all. It may be a chemical situation, and to give yourself a lot of grace and mercy in that situation, because you know a lot has happened. You grew a human being, and you know you birthed the human being, and now your body is trying to reorganize itself to no longer be devoting all of its energy to growing this person, but going back to helping you grow mm-hmm. you and heal you. So there's a lot of chemical shift going on there. And there's a lot of environmental shift. I mean, think about when you were pregnant versus when you have the baby. I mean, environmentally, the way you related to your surroundings and the way other people relate to you changes. And, you know, it just does. It's just a function of the anticipation of having the baby. Everyone's excited. But you have the baby, and then maybe 2 weeks later, no one calls anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I'm speaking in general terms. That may not be everyone's experience. But then again, you may have all the support in the world and still feel like you are depressed.
Alone, yeah.
Yeah, alone. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wanted to add to that, if treatment for this, definitely go and talk to your doctor to make sure there isn't a thyroid issue. I think it was one of the concerns. If you go on the website, they'll talk about that. You need to make sure that it's not actually something that can be medically treated. And I have my clients who come in. One of the things that I want to make sure of is, have you seen a PA before I start doing anything with you for some of these conditions? Because it might be a physical phenomenon or an organic or biological phenomenon that you can be treated for. But ideally, what we would like to see is if somebody needs to be medicated for depression or anxiety, we would like them to also have psychotherapy. Research has demonstrated that psychotherapy in combination with pharmacological substances is the best outcome. So just taking a pill doesn't yield the best results. And if you need medication, just going to psychotherapy isn't going to yield the best results. So I would encourage moms that this is not, you are not weak or you're not a bad mom if you need to take something to get you out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you just, that's the answer. And that's okay. It's okay. You still love your baby. You're still a great mom. I know I'm harping on this, but I can't encourage moms enough. It's one of the things that I love about my job is that I get to talk to moms and I get to be a champion for them when they're vulnerable and they just don't have the energy to do it. I get to be their cheerleader. And I love it. So,
yeah. Well, speaking of, you know, moms, there's also dads, and usually they're
yes.
usually they're married. And so that's my segue into this interesting, well, I don't know if it's interesting. The more I look at it, the more I'm like a bunch of, you know, publications put out that there was this new study that millennials have wrecked the American divorce rate. But the more you kind of look into it, we're also marrying much, you know, in fewer numbers. But so how do you kind of like, is this actually a positive thing for our society? Like people kind of like, I mean, yes, it's probably good for marriages that they're staying together, but at the same time, like we kind of see this kind of continued breakdown of the nuclear family. So I have a hard time kind of looking at these numbers and then putting it together with what I kind of like observe about our society and children and the family unit and things like that. So what was your takeaway or what do you think you should be weighing this with a grain of salt on whether this is good or not?
Okay, so if you, and I think we have the link to the actual study. The study has been submitted for publication. So when you look at it, it's going to be, that's what you're going to see. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that the author controlled for the fact that we are, that millennials are marrying in fewer numbers. So that wasn't a reason for why there was a decline in the divorce rate necessarily. I could be wrong about that, but I want to say that that's, he did control for that. Uh-huh. One of the things that I also think that millennials, if I'm not mistaken, are having fewer kids or more kids. I don't know. I can't remember where they are in the children. I think I've seen both of those things. But okay, so as far as whether or not we need to how to look at this research, when you're looking at any research, and this is the caution that I wish I could just everyone would hear this. Make sure that it's not the first of its kind. Well, when we look at research, we want to see stability in the numbers over time. And a lot of what you see today, because we're in the 24-hour news circle, is that, you know, somebody comes out with a study, it says something amazing or different, mm-hmm. or, you know, shatters the traditional view of something, and we run with it. Well, if it's the first of its kind, and it's the study, it's number one, it's like the beta test study, yeah. We don't know if that's going to yield results over time. We don't know how that's going to be 10 years from now. We can't know that. And a lot of what we're seeing is that kind of enthusiasm, excitement, you know, especially we love to weaponize studies. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we like to beat our opposition over the head with things we like. Well, I would be guarded about doing that because we really don't know. So I would say that about it, first of all. So is it interesting? Absolutely. Is it encouraging? I think so. Mm-hmm. Now, the author has attributed it to marrying later, being more educated, and let me change that. The individuals who don't divorce, and he used women. He was going looking at women in the study. Women, baby boomer women, tend to divorce later in life. They're like the gray divorce wave, I think is what he calls it. But among millennials, women are the ones who are staying married, rather, and there was a difference, are ones who marry later, are educated, and financially are in a better position. So these are, you know, I guess you could say it's the stability of the situation, but I think that there's more to it. Yes, does environment help to produce, does stable environment help to produce a stable relationship? Well, it can't, it doesn't hurt it. Let's just say that. I mean, we do have instability in environments that aren't, that are stable, but, it has more to do with the relational, the way that millennials relate in marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fascinating. The next study I'd like to see is actually the dynamic between husbands and wives in millennial relationships.
Right.
And I'm going to just prognosticate here. I don't know if this is true or not, but I would imagine that millennial relationships have a far greater egalitarian mm-hmm. Feature than we ever saw with the baby boomers. So,
yeah, I would say just again, I only speak for myself, but I would say that in all of my, you know, I'm an older millennial. I'm kind of at the very top of the age range. Me, Kim, that my relationships have all been very much like that. Like we've always both contributed financially as well as, you know, to household chores and even to, you know, like, you know, well, my daughter's dad and I were never married, but still, you know, like he has had, you know, obviously with my accident and everything, had the bulk of kind of child rearing with her, which I apologize. She is sick right now and laying in my bed while we're doing this. So that was the coughing. So for everyone listening, she apologized right after I hit the mute button.
That's totally fine.
Yeah. When she pulled a little bit ago, she pulled a tissue out of the box and you were talking and I quickly hit the mute button. I was like, okay, blow now. So anyway, so there's some breaking down the fourth wall for you people.
That's wonderful. You people, I love it. Yeah. I'm sorry. Good.
Oh goodness, I had something on my brain that I was gonna talk about really, really quickly, but I don't even remember what it was, and it must not have been important. But this has really been, I mean, we could probably go on for a long time. I didn't want to get too far afield with these things. I will say that with, you know, again, years ago, you know, I can't remember his name right now. Shoot, I should have looked it up before the game. Before the podcast. You can tell I've been watching too much baseball lately. You know, we've seen a lot in the past, you know, that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So the NFL, you know, has the players all in wearing pink and things like that. But a couple years ago, one of the players who had suffered with, I believe, bipolar disorder, wanted to wear green shoes. He went ahead and wore the green shoes, even though was told that he would be fined because it was during the game, during Mental Health Awareness Week, and he was fined. I think that kind of thing, when you were talking about stigma, you know, those kind of things aren't exactly helpful. I get that there is, you know, league, you know, dress that you have to be, you know, in compliance with. But when we, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, when you let one thing happen, you know, then the flood comes in. And it's not like I'm against breast cancer. I'm a woman. I'm, you know, it's like, probably, yeah, you know, yeah. It's like, it's not something that I'm like not sympathetic towards, but, I mean, my chance at getting, you know, breast cancer is probably as good as anybody else's someday. But at the same time, I do think that kind of thing doesn't help on a societal level and an organizational level. I don't want to sit there and say it's not fair, but it does kind of lend some, you know, that there's a little bit of preference or not preference for other things and not, but when, you know, more people suffer from mental illness than suffer from breast cancer, I believe. I looked these numbers up a couple years ago when I wrote about it. But, you know, and it's not putting one over the other. I always hate that, you know, it's not like I, you know, want breast cancer to be ignored for mental health, you know, awareness. That's not it at all. It's like, you know, this is not a zero-sum game. The pie is big. Our attention spans can obviously hold a lot of information because we have constant change. Like you said, the 24-hour news cycle, we could fit in a little bit more about it and maybe a little bit less about, you know, rape allegations. You know, not rape allegations, but you know what I mean. I'm talking about Kavanaugh, yes. Which, so I don't want people to be like, you don't think we should be talking about rape. No, I'm talking about real ones.
You know, it's you, I think just totally tangentially, it's, and you almost want, you have to put in all these disclaimers to say that because I have not addressed this does not mean that I don't care about X. It's just, mm-hmm. I only have an infinite amount of time in which to speak or to express an idea. We certainly have a lot of awareness of breast cancer, and you know, I've run in the Komen races. I mean, I'm not unsympathetic.
Oh yeah, I have too, yeah.
Either. And so, but as far as the NFL, I mean, I you know, I'm very libertarian when it comes to the marketplace, and I you know, the NFL is, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah,
you can find people for one particular thing, and you can be totally unfair because you're, you know, you're an organization that is profit run and profit driven, and you guys can do whatever you want. I do agree with you though, that perhaps if they were willing to kind of open the aperture a little bit and allow people to have, you know, an ability to express something like that. I don't know. Again, I mean, do I think it's sending the wrong message? Yes. Do I support their ability to do it? Yes.
Yeah. And does it, and I guess you could also question, does wearing these things, whether it's green for mental illness or pink for breast cancer or any other, or, you know, rainbow patches for pride, for gay pride, does it do anything is also a good question, you know, does this raise awareness at all? You know, it's like, okay, we're aware, but now what, you know, kind of thing.
I attend it. So because this is my outlook as a therapist is generally tends to go with what is the underlying feature here and what's the goal or the functionality of doing this. I think that the individual you're talking about when he wanted to wear the green shoes, that had personal significance for him. And it was probably something where people would be asking and he would have a platform for which to talk about that. So, you know, looking at whether the functionality of something, what why is someone doing this? What is the function of this? I think is my first question. Whether or not it actually raises awareness, I don't know. I do know that we have causes that are preeminent in everyone's mind. I mean, everyone knows what pink is. I actually am embarrassed to say I did not know that the mental illness color was green. I apologize.
The more you know, Allison.
You made me aware.
Yeah, Brandon Marshall is his name, and he played for the Chicago Bears in 2013 and got fined $10,500 for green shoes. That just went, wow. So I don't get a bunch of messages back. So, but yeah, nope. And I agree. You know, it's the NFL gets to make whatever, you know, decisions that they make. And Brandon Marshall went into it knowing he was going to get fined, and he chose to do it anyway. Which, you know, it's like, it seems like fines come around all the time for right. professional sports players,
right.
or sports ball, as Kim would call it. So,
well, and the other thing is, I mean, think about, you know, the fine actually made it heightened awareness, because now we're talking about it some odd 5 odd years later. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we there's a story there. So he, you know, he may have been fined, but it was $10,000 worth of really great publicity, because yeah. we're still talking about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that in and of itself has value. And I also, you know, what's $10,000 compared to your $1 million? I don't know what his salary was, but it seems like a ding. And you're right. They probably have, you know, accounts set aside for fines. Like, they put money in there. I don't know.
We like to imagine that, right?
I assume. I mean, you know, it's like you have your little fine slush fund that.
Yeah. You know, it is. Speaking of NFL, and I don't know how much, you know, people have been talking about how, you know, oh, the game has changed so much, but with all the, you know, when we're talking about the brain damage that we now know is happening with the NFL, it's like, well, yeah, the game's gonna change. Right. So, but Alice, go ahead.
Oh no, I was gonna say Nick Fisher, I know she's on Twitter, she does a lot with that too, so, you know, she'd be a great resource if anybody wants to go follow her. She's fantastic when it comes to understanding that.
Yeah,
so
awesome. Well, Allison, thank you so much for taking time out of your Saturday and coming to join
pleasure.
Me. Yeah. So where can everybody reach you?
I'm on Twitter at ADP Efferson. And so you can reach me there.
All righty. Well, everybody, go subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review and give us comments and feedback and let us know how we did this week. And we'll talk to you on another episode of The Right Side Podcast. Bye.